We'll hear argument now in the case of Sublette against John Wiley and Sons.
May it please the court?
Mr. Darst.
Thank you, Your Honor. This is a case of race discrimination involving the failure to promote in the year 2000 and the failures to promote in the year 2000. There were four openings in 2000 and failures to promote plaintiff in 2002. As to the 2000 promotions, the year 2000 promotions, the motion for summary judgment addressed one issue, and that was the statute of limitations issue. While the case was pending, the Supreme Court issued the decision of Jones versus R.R. Donnelly and Sons, stating the statute of limitations for Section 1981 case was 4 years, and the defendant had argued that the statute of limitations was 2 years. Since the Supreme Court had ruled against the defendant, then that took the argument involving the year 2000 promotions out of the motion for summary judgment. The district court, however, attempted to address issues that were not raised in the motion for summary judgment as to the year 2000.
I thought the parties had quite an exchange, though, on the pretext arguments and the like. I mean, maybe not under exactly the same headings, but it looked to me like this had been ventilated pretty thoroughly.
Well, the pages of the appendix A34 and A35 show the argument that was raised in the motion for summary judgment in the opening brief, which was the statute of limitations argument.
I know that's the legal heading, but I thought, in fact, by the time the summary judgment motions were fully briefed and the like, this pretext argument was before the district court, that both parties had discussed it.
No, Your Honor, the issue was not. The issue was not raised by the defendant in the motion for summary judgment. Now, we did rely upon the facts that there was pretext in the 2000 failures to promote, just as the court can do. When the court receives an opening brief raising one issue on, say, the year 2000, then the court can cite the other facts showing that there was a prima facie case and pretext and anything else, any other matter other than what was raised in the opening brief to the court. So the court is free to discuss the facts, and that's the same with the parties. The parties are free to discuss the facts. So when one issue is raised with us, then we can say, well, look, here, the defendant has not raised any issue of prima facie case or pretext on the year 2000. Therefore, that evidence can be used as the past treatment and history by the defendant of the plaintiff to show that this discrimination had been going on even before the year 2000, when plaintiff had been recommended by her supervisor for promotion, and the white supervisor even refused to consider her and told the supervisor to change the evaluation of the white employee named Heidi so that
right.
Heidi could be promoted to the senior.
Before we get any further with this, the district court makes a remark at one point about who's the employer, and I wonder if you could clarify for me when Wiley and Sons became the owner of IBG Books or Hungry Minds, or, you know, there are all these changes in name of her employer. Did Wiley and Sons own IBG Books when she started working for it?
No, Wiley and Sons acquired or purchased Hungry Minds, which she worked for, or IDG Books.
Does the record show when they made that purchase?
It does, and at Appendix A38, we have the answer of the defendants to our interrogatory, which states, in about September 2001, John Wiley and Sons, Inc. acquired Hungry Minds, Inc.
So So in 2000, what's your theory? Successor corporate liability or something?
Certainly, Your Honor, and that was not even raised. The defendant did not claim that it was not a successor corporation, did not claim that it only purchased some of the assets, did not claim anything like that. They, as a matter of fact, they stated that they acquired Hungry Minds, Inc., the whole thing. And then it says, and 3 months later, in January 2002, John Wiley & Sons, Inc. changed the name of Hungry Minds to Wiley Publishing, Inc., a wholly owned subsidiary of John Wiley & Sons. Now, on the motion for summary judgment, the defendants claimed that the Wiley Publishing, the renamed later, the second defendant, should be the defendant. So we added them as the second defendant, or should be the defendant, so we added them as the second defendant. Now, there was no argument by the defendants that Wiley Publishing was not a proper party. And yet the court reached out and said, well, you know, I don't know what the situation was, and you cannot enter summary judgment on that kind of record, but said, certainly neither one of these was the employee. Was the employer, but obviously they were the successor employer.
Right. Going back to your earlier point, though, I just want to suggest two things. One, our review, of course, of the summary judgment is de novo, and you've indicated kind of at least through the back door that all the pretext and the other information was discussed by the court, was before the court, people had a chance to say what they had to say. Secondly, on the merits of that, I find it very difficult to see this, to see how your client met her burden of showing pretext. It does seem that the company comes forward with non-discriminatory explanations for each of these decisions, and there's, you know, qualifications being one thing, or the misunderstanding about whether she really wanted the job and whether she had the conflict with that other employee. And what's your evidence that would let a rational trier of fact find that these were pretextual?
There was no basis in fact for the statement that plaintiff had a conflict with the other employee. It was completely false.
But why isn't that a they say that, at least on its face, it's possible. People do have conflicts sometimes, so they say that. And then they say, well, then we learned that there wasn't, and so we gave her the promotion.
Well, those possibilities are inferences, are competing inferences, which may be drawn by the jury or may be argued before the jury, but that is not an undisputed fact to grant summary judgment on. First of all, it is undisputed that the reason was false. Undisputed that the reason was false. There was no conflict between plaintiff and the other employee.
There's a difference between false and mistaken.
Right.
Well, first of all, the facts were false. Now the defendant says, oh, well, we were mistaken about the facts. We were mistakenly believing that the facts were true. But there's no dispute that the facts were false. Now, whether the defendants...
I don't understand how facts can be false.
There was no... False. Pardon me?
I think you mean the beliefs were false.
Yes, and the underlying facts themselves that
facts
there was any...
Facts cannot be false.
Oh, okay.
They're either facts or they're not.
All right, sir. Well, there was no fact, maybe I could say it that way, that there was a conflict. There was no conflict. They made it up. As a matter of fact, this follows...
The record is certainly disputed that they made it up. They said, this is what we thought, and when we received more information... We realized it wasn't a problem, and so in the space of something like 6 weeks, you know, she got the promotion. So the question is, what evidence can she come forward with to suggest that this explanation is simply a lie?
Well, first of all, she has her previous supervisor who had recommended her to these people, and they refused to even consider her and told the supervisor to change the review of the white employee. That was even before this, showing that they did not want to promote her and were trying to make up reasons. Secondly, Reeves, the Supreme Court case, says you can't just accept someone's statement from the defense saying, oh, well, I was mistaken, and accept it as face value. That's a self-serving, impeached statement, impeached by the self-serving nature of it. Now, the plaintiff can offer such statements, but on a motion for summary judgment, the defendant cannot offer. It's only from disinterested witnesses. The Reeves case says, should the court look to in order to accept something as just true. You can't have a defendant coming in saying, oh, well, it was false, but I was mistaken or something like that. I'm innocent,
in other
words. I
think you're reading a lot into Reeves. But anyway, you're running short on time. So if there's
all right, well, I will reserve my time. But let me address another point to your question. You said that the issue may have been raised. It was never raised. It was never raised, and even there was no heading, as you point out, and if something is perfunctorily raised in some other heading, perfunctory arguments are not raising an issue. Also, we are entitled
Thank
when
you,
it is not
Durst.
Raised. Oh, I'm sorry.
Ms. Klein.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Plaintiff Latera Sublett asserts that she should have received each of her two promotions earlier than she did and without having to complain that she felt deserving of those promotions, and she asserts that her 2001 and 2002 performance appraisals were less favorable than she deserved. The District Court properly granted summary judgment on the plaintiff's claims. All the evidence that the plaintiff put before this court was thoughtfully considered by the district court and was found wanting. Some of the evidence that was offered was inadmissible as broad-stroke suppositions or for lack of personal knowledge. Other parts of the evidence that were offered were simply irrelevant to the plaintiff's claims, and some lacked sufficient evidentiary value, such as hiring data that was offered without any statistical analysis or underlying evidence as to what openings existed and what qualified applicants were applying for those positions. Turning to the first of the two promotion claims, the summer of 2000 promotion claim, it is undisputed that the plaintiff applied for that position in the summer of 2000, and when she did not receive that position, she sent a memo on July 24th of 2000 stating that she felt that she was deserving of the promotion. The day after the responsible HR manager received that memorandum, the HR manager conducted a meeting to find out the reasoning why she was not offered that position and then brought in the plaintiff to listen to those reasons and allow her an opportunity to respond. Those two reasons, as have been mentioned before, were that she did not express the enthusiasm the supervisors were looking for in the job interview, and secondly, that they understood that there was a conflict with a coworker. And as was discussed before, the reason for the belief on that part by one of the two hiring supervisors was that the coworker involved had come to that hiring supervisor and said that the two were having a difficult time with their working relationship. So there is no evidence of pretext that those reasons why that position was not initially offered to the plaintiff were pretextual, and the trial court correctly concluded that the delay between the initial denial of the promotion and the discussion that led to the supervisors changing their minds and offering the plaintiff promotion was too minimal to be actionable.
But, and you know, I wanted to raise two things here, Ms. Klein. It seems to me the gist of Mr. Darst's argument is that because, for understandable reasons at the time, you were relying on the statute of limitations, as I understand it, he's really saying that they didn't have notice that they needed fully to present their argument on, you know, pretext, prima facie case, whatever, you know, the merits of the 2000 promotion. It just sort of came up in the interstices, and without that focus, they really have been deprived of some opportunity. That's the first thing. And the second thing, I'm a little disturbed by what seems to be your argument that even if somebody for impermissible racial reasons, you know, on July 7th denies you a promotion and then they turn around and give it to you on August the 15th, that you haven't been damaged. You have been. Maybe your damages aren't that huge. Maybe it's just, you know, a short number of weeks of back pay or something. But surely, I mean, you're entitled to a non-discriminatory decision, right?
I think that's correct, Your Honor. Let me address your second point first. I think that that is true, and if the first and most important point is that there simply is no evidence that the initial decision for the denial of the promotion was racially discriminatory. If there was such evidence, then I think I would agree that the question is the amount of damages based on whether the situation was rectified, whether it was voluntarily rectified rather than by being ordered by some authority to rectify that, and what the circumstances of the plaintiff was working under during that interim. But in this case, the question really doesn't arise because of the complete lack of evidence of racial discrimination in that initial decision. As to the question of whether the plaintiff had an adequate opportunity to respond to the pretext argument, I think it is correct that this, although there was a change in the law that muddied the waters a bit throughout the briefing process, this claim was fully developed on both sides. When the change in the law occurred, the plaintiff was still maintaining that even if this was a time-barred claim, it was still relevant background evidence, so that it was significant and the facts were fully developed. And in fact, throughout the briefing process, it was never presented as a substantive claim, even after Jones versus Donnelly came down. So to the extent that there was no response on the basis of it being a substantive claim, it was because it was actually never raised. It was raised in supplemental authority submitted after the briefing process. I think the district court simply took a very practical approach, recognized that the sequence of events was a bit odd because of the change in the law, and treated it as a viable substantive claim that was fully developed and each party had a sufficient chance to state their facts. Moving on to the promotion to team leader, in early 2002, the company restructured its teams and created four teams along product lines, and at that time, there was a new job description developed for the team leader position. That job description clearly stated that college was desirable and prior supervisory experience was highly desirable. So when the plaintiff applied for the one position for which she applied in February 2002, the position went to an individual who had a bachelor's degree in business and had 2 years of supervisory experience, and there is simply no evidence that the employer did not honestly believe, applying the criteria that it had established, that the individual selected was most qualified. The next position in June of 2002 that came up, again, went to an individual who had an associate's degree and had 9 years of supervisory experience, plus additional coursework in marketing. And again, there is simply no evidence that it was not an honest selection of what the company considered the more qualified applicant. I think the trial court correctly concluded that the company legitimately decided that both of these candidates were undeniably superior on legitimate business criteria and that there's no reason to disbelieve those criteria. Moving to the performance appraisals, the trial court correctly recognized that the trend that would evidence discrimination or retaliation is simply not evidenced by these appraisals. The June of 2000 performance appraisal had 40 different categories of evaluation, and the plaintiff was rated as the middle category as competent or developing on 37 out of 40 categories. She did get a superior rating in three of the 40 categories. In September of 2001, the scale had changed. It was a 1-3 scale, and she was rated as proficient across the board. Then in September of 2002, it was again a 4-point scale, and she was rated as acceptable with qualifications in 4 of 6 categories and as fully met in 2 of these categories.
Are all of these appraisals, or whatever you call evaluations, connected to either a pay increase or a promotion?
They were connected to pay increases, Your Honor, and it is undisputed that there is no evidence that there would have been more money attached to a more favorable evaluation. There is no evidence that anyone who was rated more highly received a better raise.
No evidence of an adverse action, I guess.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. And the trial court concluded first that the evidence that these performance appraisals were lower than the plaintiff deserved was based purely on her own assessment of her performance, which is not sufficient. The trial court also questioned the conclusion that these are even negative evaluations. They basically show someone who is performing at a satisfactory level. And as was pointed out, there is no effect on the plaintiff's career sufficient to qualify these as either discriminatory or retaliatory. Furthermore, the timing of these performance appraisals in relation to the promotions was not sufficient to show that there was any causation. In conclusion, Your Honors, as Judge Barker noted, this case does not involve particularly intricate facts or complicated law. The district court did not ignore any admissible evidence in the plaintiff's favor. Rather, she took the evidence for what it was worth. Although the court does draw all justifiable and reasonable inferences in the plaintiff's favor based on admissible evidence, it is not the court's role to fill in evidentiary gaps and convert conclusory allegations or speculation into a genuine issue of fact. If there are no further questions, I would simply ask that this court affirm the district court decision.
Thank you, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.